Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, chair of the club's Humanities Member-Led Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Amy Summers. Amy is an attorney in Shanghai. She has been living there for many years and has a thorough knowledge of the Chinese stimulus plan, which she's going to share with us today. Amy?
It's a pleasure to be here this evening, and I'm a little bit shorter than George, so I'm going to adjust this microphone. I have lived now in China full-time since 2004, and prior to that was based in the United States, but spent a lot of time in China. And my hope today is to use the discussion of the stimulus plan to actually talk a little bit or explore a little bit with you ways in which China is maybe strong or maybe weaker than we typically see it presented in the media in the West. My sense, living outside the United States, is that China is often presented in this very monolithic way and seen as this very powerful country with a really strong central government that is able to, by fiat, accomplish huge things. And some of that is definitely true. But I think when we look at other parts of what's going on in China, we see that there are real challenges besetting the country, and the picture is much more mixed and nuanced. And I suspect that a number of you may be involved in China, and so I would welcome you to give feedback or share your experiences as we go through tonight's talk. So, you know, China is one of these places where we get lots of great numbers, and the numbers are always very daunting. And if you look at the numbers that relate to the stimulus plan, and we're now midway through the first year of it, so the National Development and Reform Commission has started producing reports on how it's going, you can see that they already have accomplished a significant number of plans or actual actions. They have built over 200,000 units of low-income housing, and they've got many more on the charts that are under development. They have over 250 electricity substations in development, and they are building thousands and thousands of kilometers of roads to serve rural areas. And we can also see that they are planning to reforest huge areas of land because deforestation is such a huge environmental issue for China. So despite this really huge plan that's very ambitious, we can also see that it represents only 3% of China's GDP. And by contrast, if you look at the budget deficit in the United States, we are looking at a figure of 12%. So there's a big difference there. And, you know, currently people are saying that the U.S. public debt cumulatively will reach something like 67% of GDP by 2019 if things continue as they are. And I forget what the percentage is for China, but it's considerably lower. So in considering the plan, then, you know, there are a lot of questions about it. And, you know, how big is it? Where is it going to be spent? In what sectors are they spending it? How are they going to fund it? Are there going to be opportunities for foreign investors to participate? This was a big question that came out of the American companies that are based in China as soon as the plan was announced last autumn. And as I said, what does the implementation of the plan tell us about China? It was announced last November, and the number was large. I think it's still the second largest plan of any country adopted since the crisis started last fall. And they, too, like the United States, want to try and spend the money very aggressively and very quickly to get maximum benefit. And so they're looking to try and spend that huge number, $585 billion U.S., over a two-year period. Supposedly, in January, when the top agencies of the government were taking proposals from the local governments who were supposed to come and say how they would spend money if it was allocated to them, all of the hotels around the headquarters of these agencies in Beijing were totally packed because all of the officials had come in from the countryside or the rural areas in hopes of getting their little sliver of the pie allocated to them. So of this big number of amount of money, a lot of it is going to be spent on infrastructure kinds of projects. And, you know, there have been a number of commentators in the United States who have said that the U.S. in using its stimulus should really also focus on infrastructure. And I don't think that the U.S. percentage probably is as high as China, but China is definitely moving in that direction. And one of the other things that they really want to do is try and improve China's social safety net, because many people believe that part of the reason why Chinese save so much is because they really don't have a very robust safety net. If you are retired, you don't really have a very large pension unless you had the good fortune to work for a large state-owned enterprise that is still active and making money, and many of them aren't. Many of the ones that are still around do make money, but the ones that were back in the day in China and big, many of those have kind of gone away or been privatized. So people are left without pensions. China used to have a very good public health system, but that got dismantled because a lot of it was tied in with the state-owned enterprises. And so people just are very worried about their health and their retirement, issues that I think Americans face too. But the difference is we go out and spend money on vacations or buy a new car, and the Chinese salt it away. And so you have these very high savings rates of, you know, upwards of 40%. So why is China so focused on infrastructure? One of the reasons is that they think that urbanization is really going to be the trend that will drive development in the coming years. And China is excellent at producing statistics and doing quantitative analysis, and they have looked at what the population trends are likely to be and what are the demographic trends, and they predict, and most people agree with this, that in the coming years, China will move from having a majority of its population in rural areas to being in urban areas. And therefore, the country has to prepare for this, but they also see it as a way to stimulate consumption, improve people's standards of living, and grow the economy in a way that isn't so export dependent. So if you look at the numbers, in 2005, China's urban population, which was larger than the United States' entire population, was 572 million. But in 2030, China is going to flip, and it's expected to have 1 billion people living in cities. And McKinsey has done some really fascinating work around this. So if you're interested in this topic, I would encourage you to go to their website and look at some of the reports they've done. But what they are looking at is what are different models that China can follow in terms of developing its cities. And there are, you know, megacity models that they're advocating as ways of increasing efficiency for use of natural resources and energy efficient use. And water is a big issue, and transportation. So these are all questions that the government is pondering as it is deciding how to proceed. And when they looked at the stimulus package, what they decided, really, if you look at it, is to put a lot of it in these areas that are going to help them deal with this growing urbanization. So they, in setting the stimulus, named seven key areas into which they would funnel the funds. One is infrastructure, of course. Another is this post-earthquake reconstruction. And then affordable housing, this goes to the safety net issue, improving rural living standards, technology upgrades, energy savings, energy efficiency is an issue, and health and education. So of that, almost 38% is going into what we would consider infrastructure projects. And so some people were very cynical about the stimulus package because they said, well, you know, China, in its fifth-year plan, was already planning on doing a lot of these things, and that is true. Maybe, you know, 25 or 30% of the funds allocated to the stimulus package had already been planned to be used, but the time period is being accelerated. And as we'll see, some of the other things going on are sort of amplifying the efforts of the government in the stimulus package. In addition to focus in terms of industry or type of investment, the government has also determined that they want to direct investment in a regional fashion. And those of you who have been to China, how many of you have been to China? Okay, so a large number of you. You probably went to major cities on the eastern seaboard. Some of you may have gone to the west, or some of you may have gone to rural areas, but if you did, you noticed that there was a difference, I'm sure, between these incredibly modern, affluent cities on the eastern seaboard and then smaller cities, tertiary or secondary cities, or even rural areas. And the government is keenly conscious of the growing disparity in wealth between the people on the eastern seaboard and those in the interior, and therefore they want to try and use this opportunity to really funnel a lot of investment into those western regions. So you'll see that a huge amount is going into Yunnan, which is in southwestern China, and Sichuan, which is also in southwestern China, and which is where the earthquake was last year. And a corresponding lesser amount is going, say, to Zhejiang, which is a province adjacent to Shanghai. It's a very wealthy province. It's where a lot of the privately owned manufacturing companies are located, where, you know, there's been a famous case with Wahaha Beverages and Danone, who have been fighting. And Wahaha used to be it was a state-owned enterprise, and this guy took it private. And he has a daughter, only one daughter, and she drives a Ferrari. And one of my colleagues met her, and he was like, "So what year is it?" She's like, "Of course, it's, you know, this was last year. Of course, it's a 2008. You know, why would you have an older Ferrari?" So, you know, this gives you a sense of how wealthy that, you know, the eastern seaboard is in comparison, say, to the more remote parts of China. So, of course, then the question becomes, well, who's going to pay for this, and how are they going to pay for it? And despite the size of the package, the central government has said that it is only going to bear a little bit over 1 trillion RMB. So that's about a quarter of the total amount of spending. And they expect the local governments to come up with one-third, but then this still leaves a significant portion, 37.5%, that has to be covered some other way. And the ways that it appears this will happen is through doing corporate types of investments or raising money on stock exchanges or borrowing funds, and we'll get into that. But you can see that there's a gap there between what the central government, this supposedly very powerful body, and then the local governments and what they're supposed to do. And as I'll talk shortly, China does have very tight restrictions on the ability of local governments to raise funds. You know, here in the United States, we have local governments who can use bond issues to raise funds. And there are limits on this, but you can do this, and it's a very powerful tool. But China requires under its budget law that revenues and expenses be balanced. I understand in the state of California this has also been an issue recently. And that local budgets are not supposed to run a deficit, and local governments are not supposed to issue government bonds. And there is an exception if the state council approves it. The state council is at the very top of the central government, the administrative or executive body, then you can. You know, you can imagine why this would be when Deng Xiaoping in the early 90s said go faster in terms of economic development. One of the things that happened as a result of that is that the central government really had to let go of a lot of control. And the localities at that time, you know, Shenzhen and Guangzhou and Shanghai, were really freed up to experiment and to go faster in terms of economic development. And once they started going faster, they didn't really want to slow down, and they didn't want to listen to the central government anymore. And so it was sort of this Pandora's box as far as the central government was concerned. And you can imagine then if you have these very aggressive local governments who want to create these fiefdoms, being able to borrow money and issue bonds would be a very powerful tool. And so this budget law provides a mechanism for trying to limit their ability to do so. As we'll talk about shortly, people in China are very creative, and they are able to find ways around this, and so it doesn't actually work as well as perhaps the central government would like. But in light of these restrictions, then you have to consider what are the funding options that are available. And really what ends up happening is that these governments will form corporations. They form development companies that are called either urban development and investment companies or city development and construction companies, and they endow them with the rights to do certain projects, like, you know, the maglev or the metro or an airport. And then the entity is allowed to go out and raise capital because it's a corporate entity. It's not the government itself, and as a corporate entity, it can go raise capital. So it can borrow money, it can list on the stock exchange, it can get private investment, it can do joint ventures. And these have been mechanisms that have been used for the last 15 years, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it does mean that you are putting, you're corporatizing a lot of your infrastructure, and there are issues that have flowed out of that decision. Last month, the Wall Street Journal reported that despite the fact that we're, you know, 5 or 6 months into the stimulus plan, that the local governments have contributed only 48% of the share that they're supposed to contribute. So remember, I was saying that they're supposed to come up with this big percentage, but they don't really have extra budget sitting around, and they've got to go out and find the money. And so far, they've only done about half of what they're supposed to do. So where are they going to get other money? And it seems pretty clear at this point that one of the places they're going to get money is through the banks. And those of you who have followed China know that in the 90s, the mantra was that the Chinese banking system was on the verge of collapse, and there was all this bad debt, and it was very dangerous, and it was so bad, and the American bankers would go lecture to the Chinese, and the American government would go lecture to the Chinese. And so the Chinese did something about it, and they reformed their system. And they are now quite cynical, and we really have lost a lot of credibility because, in fact, the Chinese banks are doing great, and the American banks are the ones that had all this bad debt. And don't think that the Chinese are not aware of this. So when Tim Geithner goes and lectures them about this, that, or another thing, they tend to look a little askance at this point. But last year, the banks were really put under some restriction in terms of their capital requirements, and they were not supposed to be really aggressively lending because the economy was overheating and the government was very concerned about a bubble building up, especially in the real estate sector. After the crisis hit in November, that changed. I mean, it was just a real about face. And so the government has said, yes, fine, go ahead and lend. And so the banks are lending. And this is probably a good thing, but I think it also has the potential to be a bad thing in the next few years. So in the first quarter, the new loans for infrastructure projects, and those are the kinds that I'm talking about where, you know, the government is setting up these companies and there may be some private ownership, either local or foreign, but it does have a government tie. Those loans totaled 894.8 billion yuan, and that is equivalent to 22% of the national stimulus package. So you can see from that number that this already very big number from the stimulus package is growing by virtue of this debt. Now, the asterisk is it also going to be smaller, though, because some of the funds that were supposed to come out of the local government's budgets haven't been contributed. So that's a bit of a question. We don't know the answer yet. In January alone, 1.62 trillion RMB in new loans, not infrastructure, just loans generally, were made. And I think that was something like 90% of the entire loans made last year by Chinese banks in all of 2008. So in a one-month period, they just opened the floodgates. And that, in a way, was very comforting to people. I mean, this winter, I'm sure you all were feeling scared and depressed. I know I was. But, you know, the Chinese were like, hey, you know, it's not all bad. And you go to the stores and the restaurants and people were out because they felt like money was available. So the Chinese banks have remained strong through the crisis, and they really do remain, as of today or as of January 2009, strong and pretty much unaffected by what was going on. I mean, they didn't get into this whole crazy residential lending. People put large amounts down or sometimes paid cash for houses. You didn't have this whole subprime thing going on. But in light of this huge uptick in lending, you do have to ask, well, what is going to happen in terms of bad debt ratios, you know, 2 years from now? And I think those of you who are here tonight, you know, when you're at cocktail parties 3 years from now and people are talking again about how bad the bank situation is in China, you can say, well, you know, I knew this back in 2009 because, look, the banks are loaning so much money. So the other thing that has gotten quite a bit of coverage in the English language business media focused on China, I don't think it's really been covered here in the general business press, is this idea that China is now going to have this pilot program for issuing bonds. And a lot of people involved in the bond market got very excited because they thought, well, now we're going to have this very rules-based system, and it's going to be like in the U.S., and it's going to be this great thing. But, in fact, it is a very limited program, and I think it will prove not to be that significant as a financing tool. The total amount that is going to be issued this year is only 200 billion RMB. So, you know, that's under 30 billion U.S., which is nothing. You know, Madoff, what did he make off with? You know, 51 billion. This is, you know, not even that amount. And the money is supposed to be funneled to go to some of these poorer provinces. The idea is, you know, they can get private investment to do the sexy maglev train, high-speed rail kinds of projects on the eastern seaboard. That's not a difficult proposition. But if you want to do low-income housing or health clinics in rural Sichuan or Yunnan, people aren't so interested. And so the idea is that this money will be used to do those kinds of projects and help with the post-earthquake recovery, because, again, that's not something that people were that interested in investing in. In terms of the process, you know, I talked about the tension or between the central government and the local governments, and they've tried to set it up in a means as a means of controlling that tendency by the local governments to go crazy. So the idea is that the local governments within their finance department have to develop projects. They're supposed to be the administrators on the ground, and then they go to the provincial People's Congress. This is sort of the comparable organization to the California State Legislature, say. And then the People's Congress decides whether or not to seek quota under this bond deal, and they apply. And then the Ministry of Finance decides how to allocate the quota. And if they approve it, then the bonds will be issued and the proceeds will be allocated to that local government to be applied towards that project. And again, an asterisk, you know, will the funds get applied to those projects? Because many people believe that some of the bank lending that's going on is being used not to fund the new stimulus projects that they're supposed to be funding. Instead, it's being used to retire old debt that's already out there, or buy Zegna suits for some of the officials. I went to a talk. It was a real estate conference a few weeks ago, and one of the brokers was talking about retail demand in Western China, and he said something like, well, you know, we represent a leading men's clothing label from Italy, and their best sales are in Chengdu, you know, far in the west. And Chengdu is, you know, a big city by our standards, you know, 6 million or 8 million or whatever, but by Chinese standards, it's not that big. But you know, there's a lot of money out there somehow floating around being spent on Zegna or some other kind of suits. So in light of all of this, then I think we have to ask, is China strong, as is typically portrayed here in the Western media, or is it weak, or is it some of both? You know, the things that we read about that make us think that this is an incredibly strong package are that, you know, they planned early on they were going to do it. They adopted the package, they decided how they would spend the money, and they're already spending it. But as I say, the local governments lack sufficient budget, and they don't really have autonomy to go out and raise taxes because of how the tax system is set up. So they really seem to be using commercial lending as a way to fund their operations. Another interesting data point is that the Shanghai Composite Index is up something like 61% since the beginning of the year. Now, I saw in the news today that the NASDAQ was up 2.5% today or something, and everybody was really happy because this is a big rally. So can you imagine from January of this year, this terrible, terrible year, until today, the composite index has gone up 61%. And I can tell you that earnings in China of the companies in the index have not gone up a comparable amount to suggest that this is warranted. So why is there all this money going into the stock market? You know, most people think that it's because companies are using this looser bank lending policy to go borrow money, and instead of doing, you know, improvements to their factory or doing M&A, well, they are doing M&A, they're just going out and putting it in the stock market. And so this is creating a bubble, and the government is worried about it. But despite the fact that the central government is worried about it, they haven't really been able to do anything about it. So again, is the government weak or is it strong? Another interesting data point is that the residential real estate market in some major cities, is actually growing now. I mean, there, last fall it either went down or it stayed steady. It depends on whether you're talking about really high-end housing or, you know, medium housing or affordable housing. But now in Shanghai and I think also in Beijing and some other cities, housing prices are actually going up and transaction volumes are going up. And so in many ways that's a good thing and it's a reassuring thing. But also people are concerned because there is this potential that people are getting too easy of access to debt and going out and speculating. And real estate speculation was a big problem in China in 2006 and 2007, and this is one of the reasons why credit was really tightened up during the end of 2007. And then, as I say, the banks are strong enough to extend all of this credit, so that is a very reassuring and good thing. Yet, we do have to ask, if so much credit is being extended and people are putting it in the stock market, or doing other kinds of speculative investment, or governments, local governments are maybe doing some speculative investment too. Maybe they're not funding these very admirable and laudatory kinds of projects. Then are we going to see a repeat of the bad debt scenario from the mid-90s? I don't have an answer to that, but I think it's a fair question. So I want to stop right there. Are people okay so far with what I'm covering? Okay, then I want to shift a little bit and talk about, for foreign investors, for those of us looking at China as, you know, people who invest or who watch investment, what do we see happening? Is there, in fact, going to be an opportunity created? And this was something that companies really hoped, especially at the time that the U.S. economy was looking so grim. And I think at this point we can say it's pretty clear that the direct beneficiaries are going to be the big Chinese state-owned enterprises or the private Chinese companies. It, you know, the intent is not really to boost up the U.S. economy. They feel that they're doing enough of that by buying our T-bills, and they're not really terribly interested in that. And, you know, that's a legitimate point. But I do think that we will see foreign-invested enterprises as subcontractors or participants in some ways, and they will be then indirect beneficiaries of this package. So what we'll see, I think, are, you know, people, as I say, being subcontractors, potentially investing. We're working on a couple of water treatment projects where there's a major FIE looking at making a strategic investment. It's a type of business that they themselves have tried to do and haven't been very successful at making money. And this local Chinese company thinks they found a model to make money doing it. So they're like, fine, if you can prove this model, then we'll invest with you. And then also, I think, as suppliers of the equipment and the technology, certainly China has a very ambitious plan to develop rail systems, and they do want to improve water treatment. And, you know, there are various kinds of projects where foreign source equipment or technology can be used, and these can be opportunities for foreign investors. So for those of you who do business in China, you are aware of this, but it is kind of an unusual system for those coming from the U.S. perspective where, you know, if you want to set up a company in the United States, you file articles of association and the company exists the next day and there's no approval really. I mean, you just set it up and you decide how to capitalize it, what kind of business you're going to do. In China, the whole system is set up around this idea of monitoring and deciding whether to invite and welcome foreign investment or not. And if you do welcome it, whether you let people own the project all on their own or do they have to have a local partner. And the tool that they've used is they have this investment catalog that they developed, and they specify categories for foreign investment. Is something prohibited, like, you know, producing cigarettes, or is it restricted, which means you can do it but you need a local partner, or is it encouraged? Is it something they really want to get people into doing? And then by default, there's a fourth category of permitted, you know, stuff that they don't really care if you do. So they're not going to give you incentives or make it easy for you, but they're also not going to restrict you. So if you look at how this is playing out in the stimulus, what it means is for these foreign companies that want to be a subcontractor or provide equipment or somehow get involved, they have to look at whatever it is they do and figure out, well, is this restricted? Is it encouraged? How does this play out? And you know, you can see from this page in the catalog, it gets into a lot of detail about what the size of the electricity power plant is or what kind of technology it uses. And so then you use this to decide, well, yeah, we can do this on our own, or no, we have to have a local partner to do it. And what the government does is typically you're dealing with the local government. You know, if you're doing one of these projects, the government has an overall economic planning or an urban planning function that sets out these goals. China's very good at setting goals and planning and all of that. And so you would deal with the local government. With the stimulus, it's a little bit different because you have the provincial governments involved and the national government, and they are helping provide funds. So, and if the project is over 2 million RMB in terms of what's needed, and you know, these are not inexpensive projects, so probably a lot of them will be, then the state council, again, this body at the very top of the government, has to approve it. But once the project is approved, then the relevant body at the local level or the provincial level will go out and put out an RFP, just as we would here. And then the question is, how do you win the RFP? And that's a whole other topic that we will not get into. So if the project is within these foreign investment guidelines that I was just talking about that allow for foreign participation, then an FIE theoretically could just bid on it. You know, a foreign invested company like Siemens, Siemens China Enterprise could bid on the project. But practically speaking, it's more likely that a PRC entity is going to understand and be able to convey, like, yeah, you really should hire us because, we'll put thousands of people to work and you know us and we're maybe we're a state-owned enterprise. So if you hire us, then the money we make in some way sense flows back to the government because you're the shareholder. But then once the primary contractor gets that bid, they can subcontract out. And so this is where some of the foreign invested technology or foreign investment participation comes in. Or the FIE could form a joint venture at the outset with a PRC party, and then they could jointly go bid on and fulfill the project. And that does happen sometimes. So if you're looking then at how these pieces all fit together in terms of what we might see in the next 2 years for these foreign invested companies, it's clear that you do have companies from overseas that have certain technology or expertise that are useful in the kinds of projects that China wants to do. Those kinds of projects are probably going to be these sort of higher tech or more capital-intensive infrastructure projects like airports or these rail projects that are underway. And then if you have some technology that can be used in sewage treatment or electricity production or water treatment, there's a lot of interest around resource saving or energy saving. The government is very interested in that indeed. Now, the specifics of how that will play out are still in flux. And then I think the sort of other angle that companies can pursue is what they're doing relevant somehow to this idea of developing the West. This Western development or Go West strategy was adopted maybe in 1999 or 2000, and it's just never really taken off for various reasons. So to the extent one has some kind of technology that would be relevant to that region, that would be considered very desirable. And looking at sort of the factors that I think are pretty important to what makes a project successful, I think really, as I said, a lot of this is being done at the local level, or it's the localities who are deciding what they need to do and how they're going to be able to improve their situation by this short-term stimulus spending. So you have to have a lot of very specific information about what's going on the local level. And so having a local partner or having a consortium of local partners makes it much easier to really understand what are the competing policy concerns or what are the real aims that local government has in pursuing this project. And in China, having strong government relations capabilities is still really important. I explain to people that in our legal practice in China, it's probably closest to maybe being like a DC government relations lawyer in the US, where, you know, a lot of what we do involves contacting people in the government to say, well, it says this in these guidelines, and how do you interpret this? Or, you know, have you adopted new regulations, or are you going to adopt new regulations addressing X, Y, or Z, and what do you expect they will provide? So having that capability is very important to success in these projects. And I think, you know, going through these various models that are being used to finance things, you know, the bank lending model and the local governments doing these public-private partnerships where they're setting up these corporations, and now with this bond financing, it means that you do have a lot of flexibility in trying to raise money in China. You have lots of choices, and that's a strength. But it also means that there isn't really a very predictable rules-based system, and for foreign companies, that's a weakness or that's a difficulty. And so this is something that you have to really sort out, because it means that there's not a lot of predictability. So with that, I will stop, and we can have some discussion and questions. I suspect that some of you may have experiences to share that would be useful to the rest of us in exploring these topics.
Well, Amy, I have a lot of questions. I'm going to ask you about things that you didn't quite deal with here, but about overall views of China.
Okay.
We'll leave this open for discussion if someone wants to actually come into the discussion. First question is, do you believe that the Rio Tinto executives will have a fair trial or not, and why?
Okay. Well, I will confess my bias here, so then you can take what I'm saying with a grain of salt or not. I tend to, in my experience, when the Chinese government launches an investigation that's very heavy-handed like this, and they know that when they do this, this is going to set off shockwaves, they only do it if there is, in my experience, some core of truth or kernel of a problem, real problem there. And so in the Western media, this was covered as though this was just gamesmanship or brinksmanship on the part of the Chinese to punish Rio Tinto, because Rio Tinto is not going to allow Chinalco to buy into the company. Instead, they're selling their equity to BHP. And I don't believe that based on my discussions with people in the industry. It sounds like the steel industry is quite corrupt in China. The way the pricing mechanisms are set are subject to a lot of negotiation and backroom dealing. And it sounds like it is indeed possible, I don't know that this is true, but it sounds like it is indeed possible that people working for companies, maybe Rio Tinto, were involved in offering to give benefits to individuals who worked for some of the Chinese steel companies to find out what their strategies were in what kind of discount they wanted on iron ore prices as against last year. So I tend to think that there really is a live issue in that case, and the question isn't really whether they will get a fair trial. The question is how successful they will be in the investigation in repelling the government's claims. And if they are not really active in pushing back at the investigative stage, then they'll be convicted at trial if a trial comes.
Well, related follow-up question to that is, mm-hmm. in industry, was the timing of the Rio Tinto executive problem related to the fact that they were turned down on their purchase?
Yeah, I don't know that it is related. I haven't heard anyone say, of the people I know in China who are involved in this field, I have not heard anyone say that they think it was related in terms of timing. What I have heard people say is that Chinese steel companies have continued to produce high levels of inventory despite the downturn, despite the fact that external demand is very weak right now. And so huge stockpiles are building up in China of steel. And therefore, people expect that next year these steel companies are going to have a tremendously difficult situation that they're facing. And if iron ore prices aren't reduced substantially, they're going to be in a tough place. And so the idea that people may have been working against the cartels, the consortium's efforts to secure, I think the consortium wanted to get a discount of something like 45% as against last year. And Japan, I think, had agreed to, I don't know, maybe somebody else knows, something like a 33% discount, and Korea was something like 25. Do you know, Song? Okay. Okay. So, you know, they took a much lower discount, and so there was then this momentum going against the Chinese to take a lower discount. And so I think the Chinese were really disturbed by what this would mean economically for these very big steel companies and the small steel companies too. So to me, that seems like the compelling factor. But what do I know?
Personal question.
Yes.
Which the introduction didn't cover. Please tell us about your background and how you became involved in China.
Well, I grew up in Seattle in a part of the city where there's a very strong Asian community. When I was going to junior high school, instead of having cookies at our bake sales, we would have hunbao or baozi. So when I was growing up, there was, you know, strong Asian presence, and I was aware of Asia. And then when I started university, it was not that long after China had reopened relations with the United States. And then there was a lot in the news about China, and I was interested in foreign languages, and I thought it would be sort of fun to learn Chinese. And I didn't really understand what I was getting myself in for. But then I got sort of hooked, and so I kept pursuing it.
And here's a real simple question. Why does the Chinese central government not fund the entire stimulus plan? Why do they just do a third?
Because they, you know, despite we read in the papers that China has all this money, and there certainly are huge foreign reserves in China, but China, in some ways, is economically quite weak, and they don't want to increase their public debt. They have problems. There's a huge problem with tax evasion because the economy is still so cash-based. I've seen this figure, and I can't recall right now what it is, but the percentage of tax actually collected as against what should be collected based on the level of economic activity is quite low. And so the government, for various factors, then feels compelled to try and seek contributions from other sources to fund this pretty ambitious effort. And this approach of getting other stakeholders to pay up has worked very well in earlier years. You know, this is what they did in rebuilding, recreating a new Shanghai 15 years ago. And those of you who are in Pudong, you know, 20 years ago when there were just warehouses and it was, you know, very low and basic, and now you go and there are all these amazing skyscrapers, would realize, you know, this model can work. And so it's worked before and they want to try it again.
Just a couple of questions on some of the numbers that you gave. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the deficit is 3% of GDP. That's the annual deficit?
Yes.
Yes,
they do. I forget what that is. It's quite, I think it's something like 20%. I don't know if anyone else knows. Yeah, it's not very high.
It's not very high.
No, yeah.
And when you mentioned that the U.S. would be up to 67% yeah. by 2015, that was annual, right? That's annual?
No. That's the overall GDP. That's not the annual budget deficit. That's the overall public debt. That was... Yeah, this was on NPR. I can give you the link if anyone wants it.
All right. What is your opinion about China asking for a new international monetary standard besides the U.S. dollar? Whether that has any real legs?
Yeah, I think, you know, that issue, the coverage I saw in the U.S., I'd be curious if people have different perspectives on this, but the coverage I saw in the U.S. made that sound like it was sort of this pie in the sky or sort of petulant sentiment being voiced by the governor of the Bank of China. But there's been some interesting stuff written about this recent meeting by the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which took place in Ekaterinburg in June. And six countries belong to it, the countries that border on China in Central Asia and Russia. and China, of course. And they met there, and this was a big focus of their issue, not just having an IMF alternate, you know, the special drawing rights beefed up, but this issue of the U.S. dollar being the international trading currency, and they sound like they all believe that the U.S. dollar is going to weaken substantially in the next few years. And as a result of that, their holdings in U.S. dollar are going to take a huge hit, and they're resentful that, in their view, the U.S.'s sort of cavalier attitude towards how we ran our economy and now what we're doing to fix it is going to have this big impact on them beyond what has already happened. And so for these reasons, these concerns, these countries are trying to figure out alternative ways to structure foreign trade and to lessen their dependence on the U.S. dollar. And China is now doing some experimental trading in yuan. They've just signed agreements with Argentina and I think Malaysia to allow trade to be remitted or denominated in yuan instead of foreign currency. And they've also expanded the right in Hong Kong to engage in debt-raising activities or currency settlement activities in yuan. So I think if you then place those activities in the context of this discussion about special drawing rights, I suspect what we will see in the next 3 years or so is an increasing effort to experiment with different ways to not fully open up the yuan, but create other ways to denominate their trade so that they're not stuck holding all these U.S. dollars. And I also think that this is one of the factors behind this big push that we keep reading about of Chinese companies to go offshore and do M&A. I think that they are looking at, you know, our dollars are going to be worth less. We better go buy stuff now. And so it's not, you know, some people have talked about it as though it's just a natural stage in China's development and they're emulating Japan or whatever. But I think it is sort of this hot potato thing. I mean, there is this stage of development argument, certainly. But I also think there's this hot potato phenomenon where they want to, you know, get rid of the dollars and at least have some mines or other kinds of resources that they can manage and make money from. Yeah, I haven't seen that article. The Chinese can be very adept at making statements to sort of smooth the troubled waters when people get upset. And certainly when Geithner went to Beijing, was it in May or June? You know, they were very kind and polite to him, and he talked about, you know, oh, don't worry, your money's safe, we're not going to go bankrupt. And, you know, the Chinese know that the United States isn't going to go bankrupt. That's not really what they're worried about. But I do think that this concern about the value of the dollar, to me it seems like it's a pretty real concern, and I'd be surprised if that's changed in the last week. But I'd love to get the link to that article and take a look at it. Okay.
Next one. My company is interested in investing in China, but we are concerned about IP protection. Obviously, people talk about that a lot. Can you talk about IP protection in China? What's going on? Is there any changes going on?
Yeah, IP protection is a great topic, and I do a fair amount of IP work, but I'm actually, you know, sort of embarrassed to talk about it because somebody who's here who works with me does far more than I do, so I would actually ask if my colleague Song Ju, who is a patent lawyer who works with us on doing sort of hard IP stuff in China, could answer that.
China. And the only concern
I would agree with that. And many people feel that what's going to ultimately change behavior is as more Chinese companies have skin in the game and their IP is what's being stolen or destroyed, they will then more actively demand protection. And the statistic that Song cites about the increasing rate of patent litigation suggests that there must be a lot of Chinese companies then using these mechanisms as well. So maybe this is a good thing.
A little like 19th century America where we stole everything from Europe.
There you go. Yes.
All right, next question. To what extent is Taiwan involved with the economic development of the central or local government?
Taiwan has been Taiwanese companies have been a big player in economic development in the eastern seaboard and in the south. They have not really been, from a government-to-government perspective, they haven't been in dealings with each other on economic development issues. But that is now starting to change. And actually, one of the things that's going on right now is that the Taiwanese government is trying to attract outbound investment from China, which I find very interesting because when I studied Chinese in Taiwan over 20 years ago, when you talk to Taiwanese people or people in Taiwan, they weren't necessarily Taiwanese, about reunification, even if they were originally from the mainland and would say, yes, we are part of the mainland and we need to reunify, they would always say, but we don't really want to do it too soon because then we'll become very poor because they're so poor and we're so rich. And who would have thought 20 years later that the Taiwanese government would be saying, please, can you come invest in Taiwan because our economy isn't so strong?
Ah. All right, here's a question. We used to hear about the decoupling of the Chinese economy with the rest of the world. Is the stimulus package finally helping the decoupling?
Well, I think it has the potential to, as part of this, as linked to this trend I talked about of urbanization, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why the government is so eager to pursue this urbanization strategy. But I talked to the head of China business for a big company we represent, and I asked him how things were going recently, and he said all of their business lines where the product ends up in China, that's the end goal is to sell it into the Chinese market, those are doing as well or even better than they did last year. And all of the product lines that are export related are in the tank. So when you evened it all out, they were sort of flat or going down. And so, I think China, for good or for bad, is still very coupled, and this idea of decoupling is something to aim for in the future, but it turned out to be a myth.
The next question, the next two questions, the last ones. Anybody else have any other questions? The next two questions are both environmentally related. The first one is, how much progress are U.S. companies making in providing green buildings or clean tech to the Chinese economy? And I'm going to start actually answering that question myself. I worked on something in 2003 where the U.S. government transferred the technology to turn coal into fuel oil, into gas, because the U.S. government decided that they would never be able to get it through in the United States, but that the Chinese government would be able to get it through and get it done, and that would help relieve some of the pressure on Saudi Arabian oil between the two, because the competition for that was pretty obvious. In Shenhua, in Mongolia, that project just opened up 2 months ago. I think the Chinese government put $6 billion into creating the facility, and they're testing the latest technology and being able to do that. It's an old technology for turning coal into fuel, but that's something for the future, and it's the biggest project like that, because everyone knows there's lots of coal, but people don't know how we're going to use it. Mm-hmm. Use cleanly. So that's one small part of it, but it's more about the green buildings. And I think everybody kind of was listening to the technology of about all the architects mm-hmm. that influenced Beijing during the run-up to the Olympics.
I helped organize a conference last year where Rob Watson, who founded the LEED Standard, was the keynote speaker, and the focus of the conference was looking at sustainable building practices. And we had a number of leading architects and developers talking. And again, this is an area where I think you see dichotomy. The central government, the Ministry of through the Ministry of Construction, the National Development and Reform Commission, they believe in and get the why it makes sense to adopt green billing standards, and they want to see that happen, and they're doing things to promote that, and they are adopting them. I mean, they're tightening building codes, and there are all these great things going on. But when you talk to architects who are building projects, what they tell you is that the local developers pay off, not always, but frequently will pay off the people who do the inspection for the plans and oversee the actual development process, the planning and land use division people in these cities. And so the criteria are not, in fact, used in the building, although the drawings are stamped as though somebody did what they were supposed to. And this, again, is the problem. Part of it is has to do with how the real estate development market works in China. Prices have appreciated so much, people don't really buy and hold the way they do here, or develop and hold. They develop and flip, or they develop and use strata title. They condominiumize the projects. And so they don't really see having energy efficiency savings in the management is really accruing to them, and therefore it's not in their interest. And so they put cheaper windows in or don't use the really good, efficient HVAC systems and all of that. So, again, I think China has, from a planning perspective, a lot of great ideas, but getting that implemented on the ground is going to be a challenge.
And one final question, unless there's any others. Can you speculate on how China's stimulus plan will affect the NDRC's efforts to reduce energy intensity of its major industrial sectors and what that means for greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because the stimulus plan itself isn't really focused directly on achieving some of these environmental goals that the NDRC has been trying to pursue with SEPA, the State Environmental Planning Agency, and that was a source of some frustration. And the other source of frustration is that because capital has been made so available through the banks, that people are doing a lot of investment in areas that, you know, don't involve clean energy production. And so people are concerned that China, in, say, 2006, 2007, 2008, had really been articulating a strong desire to do more in terms of macro planning and development to achieve energy efficiency, and that with the stimulus package, they sort of backed away from some of that. And that is maybe not such a great part of how this is playing out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Those are great questions.
That brings to an end another session of the Commonwealth Club with Amy Summers, Shanghai attorney with Squire Sanders. Thank you very much.